Welcome back to the podcast. In today's podcast, I'm going to be speaking with Thomas Bjorkman, who is an applied philosopher, a social entrepreneur. He is an author, too, of books such as The Nordic Secret and The Market Myth. And we're going to be talking about the shift that we're going through in the world right now. In case you didn't notice, things have got a bit weird and feels to me certainly like old systems are breaking down in some way. We're in some kind of liminal space. So that's what we'll talk about today. Thomas will talk about the immensity of the kind of shift that we're going through, why it's not, you know, akin to some of the lighter, if I could use that word, transitions that we've been through in humanity, but actually it's deep. It's a kind of phase shift. So we'll talk about kind of some of the characteristics of this shift. We'll talk about some of the lessons we might learn from what happened in Scandinavia 120 years ago. We'll talk about what we might do in these times, you know, how we might orient and what practices we might take on that will take us through these times. We'll talk about myth and these collective imageries that we kind of just believe in that might be needing a kind of innovation and update. And I think this is important for coaches because this is about societal shift. And, you know, we're not just coaching individuals within bubbles. You know, they live and work within organizations, within societies and communities. And so I think it behooves us to kind of get a sense of like what is going on this larger scale and how might knowing that help us orient the work that we're doing and inform the work that we're doing. So that's my wish in putting this podcast out. I think Thomas has got a brilliant mind and an important message. And I also recommend checking out some of his, the organizations he's connected to, whatisemerging.com and Perspectiva. He'll also mention some of the others in the podcast today. So check them out. Okay, that all being said, what else do I want to say? Well, other than I hope you enjoy this, that if you're not on our mailing list and you want to sign up and stay in the loop about things, you can head to coachesrising.com and sign up there. You'll also see some of the other cool stuff we've got going on. So let's dive in. Here's the podcast with Thomas Bjorkman. I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for. So we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. It's the most potent move I can make. Because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do. And it can't feel, it can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. So yeah, Thomas, it's great to be with you. It's taken a while for us to get here, but like nearly a year, I think.
I'm very happy that we are now finally doing this. So thank you for having me on your podcast.
Yeah, I think we just touched into one of the reasons why I'd love to have your voice in our community, because we spoke just briefly about that many coaches, I think, have been focused on the individual and integrated, you know, helping people make individual change. And that's important, but I think it's insufficient in these times. And so there's something about the societal level and the change there needed that's so essential. And so we're going to talk about that today and many other things. Maybe you could just, I think the first question I have is, what do you see as being the shift that we're going through in these times? I think we're all feeling it. We're all trying to make sense of what's going on. And I'm turning to you now for the answer. Whenever, sure. How are you making sense of this shift?
Sure, sure. Yeah, it's difficult because I think that the shift that we are going through right now, and I think it's good that we are now more and more recognizing that this is really a shift, that we are not just talking about a change or that we need to adapt or that we need to evolve a bit, but that we are actually going through a shift or a phase transition. And I actually think that this shift that we are going through now is very deep. One could ask ourselves how deep this could be. And I usually say that it is, I think, at least as deep as the shift we went through as humanity, at least in the West, when we went from the pre-modern world to the modern world, when we went from a medieval, religious, dogmatic worldview and a feudal society to a scientific, rational worldview through the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution. And we developed democracy in the wake of this shift in worldview. So I think that the shift we are going through right now is equally deep, and that we are just seeing the beginning of this shift. Mm. And it will put a lot of demands on us as individuals. And that's also why it's important with this connection to the personal inner development. Just staying with the old transition or shift a little bit. My colleague and friend Lena Andersen, the Danish philosopher and author, and we wrote a book a few years ago called The Nordic Secret, where we were telling the story about how the Scandinavian countries managed this previous shift in a very successful way. One could even argue, and we argue in the book, that the Scandinavian countries managed this transition more successfully and more peacefully than any other countries in the world. Now we are the first one to point out in the book that we in the Scandinavian countries are losing whatever we had a little bit, but we certainly were on to something back then. And this something is interesting. So if you allow me to stay a little bit on this, because I think it can frame and help us understand the transition that we are in right now. Because back then, 100 or 150 years ago, we had very visionary intellectuals and politicians in all the Scandinavian countries who actually saw this previous transition coming. They knew that we had industrialization and urbanization coming, and in such times of rapid social change, it's only natural for us humans to want to have some sort of external authority to hold on to. That could be a dogmatic religion or an authoritarian leader. Today, that would be an Erdogan or a Trump. But these politicians and intellectuals, they didn't want to be authoritarian leaders. They were firmly committed to build democracy. And they knew that the only way to build democracy is from bottom up. So they wanted to help create the support for a lot of people in these countries to actually take this very important developmental step in life that we can take as adults. And using Professor Robert Keegan's language, that is when we are going from a socialized mind into a more self-authoring mind, by that becoming less dependent on external authority for our values, but also for our personal worth, and more becoming in a much more deeper sense authors of our own lives. So in these times of rapid transition, we need more people in society that are actually capable of being self-authoring and thereby being able to guide themselves and their communities through these times of uncertainty. And the way that they did this more than 100 years ago in Scandinavia is quite astonishing, because the best way I could describe this today would be that they actually created a lot of retreat centers for personal development. So, and they created lots of them. So by the turn of the last century, year 1900, there were 100 centers like this in Denmark alone, 75 in Norway, and 150 in Sweden, where young adults in their 20s, later on with full state subsidy, could spend up to 6 months in retreat with the expressed aim of starting their journey towards self-authorship. And when this program was at its height, almost exactly 100 years ago, then 10% of each young generation in Scandinavia had the opportunity to participate in one of these 6 months retreats. And of course, this created what we today would call some sort of critical mass in society. Isn't that an amazing story?
It is, yeah. Like,
to 150 years ago, see this connection around between inner personal development and societal change, and how inner personal development could be an antidote towards authoritarianism, and what is especially needed in times of rapid social change and chaos.
And I find that an incredible story, actually, and one that we're crying out for right now, you know, to hear of initiatives like this in this time. And that brings up the question for me about, well, two questions in one, which is, you know, do you think that we need to replicate something like that in order to help us maybe create a new tipping point? Or would it, you know, look differently? We have things like the internet now and global society. And then coupled in with that question is this sense of this powerful shift from socialized mind to self-authored. And, you know, now you hear of people speaking about the need for us to evolve from self-authored to self-transforming, what Keegan calls self-transforming mind, in order to be able to deal with the complexity of the world. And so do you think that's also true? And so those are my two questions.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. So yes, I think we can learn a lot from what was going on in Scandinavia back then. And if you read the book, The Nordic Secret, you will also read there how this was not just in Scandinavia, but this actually traveled to the US and had implications for the civil rights movement in the US and other interesting things. But I don't think we should see what we did in Scandinavia 100 years ago as a blueprint for what we should do today. As you rightly point out, today we are in a digitized world and we are in a global world. I personally do not think that there is any better way to facilitate and support personal development than doing it face-to-face in small groups, preferably close to nature. And that was exactly what was happening at these retreat centers that were called Folkai schools, and they were often in nature and relatively small groups. And that is what we are also doing. My foundation in Stockholm, the Ekredet Foundation, the Oak Island Foundation, we have our own retreat center out in the nature in the Stockholm archipelago, where we do personal development and youth camps and invitational conferences and other things. So I'm a big believer in the in real life, authentic meetings out in nature. But having said that, it's not easy to scale. And to believe that we all over the world should all of a sudden start investing in centers like this to be able to support 10% of the global population, I think that would be wonderful, but not perhaps realistic. So I more see what Lena and I describe in our book as a case study showing that this talk about the importance of personal development, just not just for the individual, but also in this societal shift, that this is not just some fancy new age idea out of California or something, but it is actually a concept that has been tried and tested on large scale in three different countries that implemented this in a little bit different way more than 100 years ago, and we can still see the positive effects. So for me, it's more a case study, an important case study than a blueprint. I do think that we can use digital support for a lot of this. My foundation is since a few years back running a project together with another foundation in Stockholm called the Norrsken Foundation, around developing an open source nonprofit digital platform for personal growth and development. It's called 29K. That's 29,000. That's the number of days you hopefully will have in your life if you live a long life. And the idea is to make them all matter. So how to help a lot of people get the most out of their lives. And what we have shown there is that very much thanks to video conferencing, because the core component in this platform is a video conferencing tool where we create small groups of 4 to 6 people who meet in self-facilitated but guided or structured conversations around personal development issues. And that is actually working. And if you can do this digitally and through self-facilitating groups, then of course you can scale this in a completely different way rather than if you're talking about doing this in real life.
Mm. Yeah, I think I still think it's incredible because knowing the amount of work it takes for people to develop, that actually they were able to go away in nature for 6 months like that and immerse themselves is so powerful. And I guess the question I have is,
and of course,
this,
sorry for interrupting you, but then of course, back then we needed all labor and people spent 6 years in school only and so on. I mean, today we have a surplus of time, and especially for those who just left university or something. So today, I would say society can in a completely different way actually afford for young people to actually go away for 6 months and do this and to grow and to become adults in a deeper sense. But for some reason, we feel today that we can't afford what they could afford 100 years ago. Yeah.
Totally. I was just thinking that before. And the question that comes up for me is the kind of change that we're going through that you mentioned before. Like this is, it's not just a transition on a more superficial level. This is actually a kind of phase shift or something. And I just wondered if you could, I don't know, in some ways it's like, we don't know what that is. Yeah. Like it's still, you said we're in the early phases, but could you say more about what you perceive the kind of shift we're making is and where we might end up.
So the first thing I should say then is that I believe that many people who are thinking about this societal shift has come to the conclusion that any deeper shift in a complex system, like our global cultural system, is a complex system. Any deeper shift in such complex system is usually emergent. And what do we mean by saying that it is emergent? It actually means that it will be turbulent, and what will come out on the other side, it is not possible to say. Not just because we lack knowledge, but because the process is actually fundamentally non-deterministic. Some people are talking about the butterfly effect. Small things can have a huge impact. And if you add on top of that the very rapid technological development that we are going through right now, for good and for bad, I believe that technology like blockchain technology and perhaps also artificial intelligence will within 5 or 10 years provide tools that will make it possible to reinvent institutions like the market or democracy in much, much more intelligent but also participatory ways. I mean, the way we structured democracy 200 years ago was essentially based on the technology of the horse. You had to select a local representative who then took the horse and carriage and traveled 2 days to get to the capital and then represented you. So today you could reinvent democracy in many different ways. And the same with the market, which essentially is such a powerful and efficient instrument because it takes all human values, a multidimensional value space, and projects that down to one single dimension of the price. And of course, that is a super efficient way of doing things, just taking one thing into consideration, and that is the price or the cost. But then, of course, at the same way, you lose so much information in this projection, and that turns up like externalities and environmental degradation and other things. So if we with blockchain technology could keep more of that information in our exchange system, we could probably have an exchange system that could perhaps be equally efficient as the market, but would take many more of our human values, both individual values, but also collective values into account. But this is all science fiction. So I'm just saying that it's very difficult to, in this emergent and space and in this rapid technology, to see where the world will be in 20 or 30 years, especially since when I'm talking to people in Silicon Valley about the technological development, many of them say that the technology that will have the biggest impact on human society in already 20 years is probably not artificial intelligence or blockchain or any of the other technologies that we know today. The technology that will have the most impact on the human society in 20 years is probably not yet invented. So in such an environment, it is difficult. And that's also why we see, of course, in politics, that it is not that easy to have a positive vision around the future. I mean, dystopia is much, much more simple. And it was easier 100 or even 50 years ago for politicians and for thinkers to actually present some sort of preferred utopia. This is where we want to go. That's not possible, credibly, in the same way today. But then I say that then it's important for us not to resign and say, well, then we don't know what is going to happen. So then let's just see what democracy and the market, where democracy and the market takes us. So we will just be spectators on this development. That is equally wrong. So when we can't focus perhaps on the positive outcome in this transition, then our focus will have to be on the process. So what is the good process for going forward? And then certainly I think that after the last couple of years now, more and more of us start to realize that just relying on the market in its present implementation and democracy, again, in its present implementation, will not take us to where we want to be in 20 years. So we need to come up with something radical here, radical.
I guess I wonder, yeah, go ahead. You want
to? No, I just wanted to say, so then how could we help ourselves to understand where we are in this trend, in this transition? And I think it's useful to look towards science in different types of knowledge systems that we usually do not need to consult. And I'm thinking about, for example, the recent surge in interest in deep history, the Yuval Harari genre of work, where we are not just looking at the last couple of hundred years or thousands of years, but going back tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and even millions of years to see these very, very long trajectories, how humans started to create society. What is a society? What is this unique human ability to create symbolic language and start to talk about abstract aspects like justice? You can't find justice out in nature. That's something that we human have come up with as a concept. And then we implement this in legal systems and in societies and in a symbolic universe. And then we start to believe in these symbolic universes. So understanding that process and how we have had these deep societal transitions many times in history, going back to the Axial Age 3,000 years ago, when many of the monotheistic religions were first formed, when we went from small hunter-gathering tribes to be able, through these new social constructs, these new collective imaginaries, to be able to build large cities and civilizations, and how this world has transformed many times, and then perhaps the last time during the Enlightenment. And what does it mean to go through such a shift? And previously throughout history, we have done this more or less not knowing what was happening. But back then, even if large civilizations have collapsed, and we should remember that most civilizations, if not all historical civilization, has collapsed. So even when the Roman Empire collapsed, that did not affect the whole of the globe. That affected a large part of Europe, but not more. And other parts were still able to thrive and to benefit even from that collapse. Whereas today we are in the unique situation that we have one global civilization, and that our human powers are such that if that civilization collapses, that might be potentially the end of humanity. So I would say that we have to give up this sort of trial and error and just hope for the best, but really try to understand what does a societal or civilization transition or transformation, what does that entail, and how can we best be in service of such a transition? So that we can learn from deep history. But then we have deep psychology. And say 20 years ago, there wasn't many people who were interested in, for example, Jungian psychology. But now we are starting to look a bit deeper into our minds and understanding that in these transitions where everything is up for negotiation. Are there any deep psychological constants like human archetypes that play an important role in these transitions? And yeah, so interest is in deep history, deep psychology, but also in deep sociology. Usually sociologists are more interested in measuring the surface phenomena of society. But as I mentioned before, looking deep, deep into the unconscious part of our society, like the collective imaginaries, and realizing that things like that we totally take for granted, like nation states, marriages, markets, and even money, but that is just human inventions. It's part of our collective imaginary, our collective belief. And if we stop believing in nation states, they are gone. If we stop believing in money, it's worthless. So what of those things can we actually let go of? And what new, similar, deep, I wouldn't say beliefs, but we need these myths and we need the collective imaginary. So we can't think that we will just get rid of these things and live without them. We need to reinvent these deeper layers of society as well. And of course, this is exciting times.
Well, there's so much in what you said. It's like it speaks to me of like this chrysalis type feeling, this liminal space that I've been feeling where, you know, it's a bit like, what is true anymore? What can I rely on? Mm. You know, we mentioned self-transforming mind, Keegan's self-transforming mind. And as you mentioned this deep history and you name all these epochs, it's like that actually, there's something about that inquiry for me that starts to have that effect of like dislodging me from my attachments to my personal imagery and my collective, I think our collective imagery too. I've been listening to this podcast, Fall of Civilizations, you know, where it charts the rise and fall of all these civilizations. And it's incredible to do that because it really expands your sense of context or security around, you know, the habituated sense of what the world is. Yeah. And so it feels like we're in this liminal space, but that there is a real potential, as you name, with this. I love that you bring up this idea of collective imagery and how we can actually begin to reimagine. Do you think that's what's happening right now, actually, that, you know, yeah, as systems collapse, we're doing that? Yeah.
I don't think we're doing it really yet, but if we are aware of the fact that we are so dependent on these collective imaginaries or subconscious parts of our society, that will, of course, when the old systems are starting to break down, then we understand that we need to invent something new. And I might just take one example here to make this a little bit more concrete and not sound so abstract, because these things are, of course, they have to be abstract because we are talking about such huge time spans and so deep transformation that it becomes very abstract. But just to give you an idea around money as a human invention or a part of the collective imaginary, and to compare that with air or oxygen, because it's not just that we humans need to realize that, say, 90% of our human world is actually just human invention and could be otherwise. Then we have this at least 10% that is nature. And those that are constructionists, they tend to think that everything is just a social construct. But then you go equally wrong as if you think that everything is just natural. So as a human living in society today, as an individual, it almost to me feels like money and air are equally important for my survival. To function in my society today and to survive, I need to have access to air, to breathe oxygen, and I need to have money so I can buy shelter and food. But of course, these two things are very different in the way that even if the whole of humanity were to come together and decide that we don't want to be dependent on oxygen any longer, we couldn't do anything about that. Whereas if we came together, all of humanity, or just a majority in a nation state, and said that we don't want to use money any longer for exchange and allocating our goods and services, we would want to have another system, then of course money could be gone tomorrow. But it's important to emphasize that agency that we have over money, over our collective imaginary, is only a collective agency. So collectively, we could decide that we want to get rid of money. As individual, money and oxygen still meets me as almost objective reality. And that's also why when you talk about what is true and what is not true, it's a different thing to talk about truth when we speak about oxygen, or truth when we speak about money, because the truth about money is contingent upon us all believing in that reality in a way that our dependency on oxygen is not. But then again, if I as an individual have this realization that money is just a fantasy, a collective fantasy, that doesn't help me when I'm at the supermarket and I'm checking out and the cashier tells me that I need to pay £150. If I tell the cashier, well, money is just a collective fantasy, so you can forget about that, they will call the police on me. Because society is reinforcing this collective belief in ways as well. And that is why we need sort of to have collective agency, to exercise collective agency to change this. But the transition that we are in right now is at the level of reimagining and reinventing things like nation states and money and some of these fundamental aspects that we more or less today take for granted and natural. I would just say one more thing. Saying that one thing that is a bit sad here is that sometimes I think that we are completely mixing these two realities up in the way that sometimes I get the impression that we believe that the planetary boundaries are up for negotiation, whereas the market forces, we just need to obey. Whereas, of course, it's the opposite. We can't do anything about the planetary boundaries. We need to adapt to them as humanity, whereas the market forces, for example, we could easily change the way they work.
Yeah, it's...
I don't know if that was clarifying or,
no, no, it does,
or more confusing.
Well, I think what comes up for me...
A lot to take in for the listeners, yeah.
Well, yeah. I think that's why I wanted you on the podcast, because I think we've often focused a lot on working with the individual in the coaching field. And now we have things like systemic coaching and... As you give this example of like the individual and the collective, I think, a lot of people working with client, for example, working with a coaching client, they go off and then they're in the collective of their company or the collective of society, and they might be seeing things differently, but then they're meeting up against the force of society that still holds certain beliefs. And so, in a way, it's like that question
and some of these beliefs, right? Like money, are sanctioned by law. So to change those things, you actually need a political decision where a majority makes a decision. But many other things of this collective imaginary is just, as you mentioned, are just beliefs that we hold. It could be beliefs of that we are these isolated utility maximizing individuals that the Enlightenment philosophers and today the neoclassical economists would want us to believe that we are. That is a belief that is permeating society completely. But that is not inscribed in any law or anything. That is just a matter of creating a critical mass who believes in something new. And then you will see a shift in the collective imaginary. Yeah. So to be aware of these processes and to be in service of those processes and see where we as individuals can support these transitions in our collective belief is very important.
Yeah, I mean, I see that happening in the coaching field, this, you know, this sense of the, you know, the high, the golden standard of the individual, you know, the leader that could individually go out and be the one that leads and to glory. And but actually, you know, through many different fields such as neuroscience, interpersonal neurobiology, all kinds that's starting to break that idea down, that the individual just doesn't exist in that way. I think we've got a sense of that with the pandemic on a collective level as well. And I guess it brings
that,
the question.
It doesn't really make sense for us all to just try to maximize our own health. If I have got the best health insurance and everything, that won't help me in a pandemic if my garbage collector or pizza delivery guy can't take a day off when he is sick, he will bring the virus to me. So my health is actually dependent on everyone having access to decent health service, for example. We can hope that that is something that we all realize in the pandemic.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think that's a painful process for me, at least in some ways, to begin to look at where am I playing that game of like, what can I accumulate and hold on to in order to maintain my own sense of well-being and safety. You know, in some ways it's a very natural human instinct, but I think perhaps collectively we might being invited to relax around that into something that brings more.
Yeah, or to be able to hold those two perspectives at the same time. Because historically we've been very much either or in our thinking. It has been either we are in a communist collectivist world or we are in a super capitalist neoliberal world. But holding the fact that, yes, we as humans, we have these instincts and individual needs, and we need to make sure that we can satisfy them in a reasonable way. But then at the same time, we are one of the most social animals on this planet. And we have this ability to invent our social world. So whereas all other animals live just in a natural world, we live in this social world that we have created. So we are like the fish swimming in the water, not being aware of the water. And once we become aware of the water, we realize that we are actually the creators of our own water. So why am I swimming in a poisonous water? That is sort of the realization. Yeah. The fish can't do anything about that, but we can once we realize that.
Because that actually, the question I had was, you said that this is a process and that it's emergent. I wonder how we're being called to be in that process, if you have any, you know, any ideas about, who we're being called to be in these times, really.
Yeah. I think, again, we can perhaps learn a bit from previous civilizational transformations and realize that we all have a role to play in these transitions. And that part of our, I don't know if I should use the word calling, that's a bit too strong, but I can't find a bit softer English word, that part of our calling today is to find our role in this transition. And that can be a very small and practical role, and it could be a bigger and more grandiose role, but I think we all have a role to play in this transition, and that we are playing a role in this transition, whether we are aware of it or not. And there the personal development aspect comes in, that I believe that the more of us that actually become aware of the fact that, yes, we are playing this role in this historical transition, the better it is. And then we realize that we, in a transition like this, we might need inner capacities and skills that might not be as urgently needed in a more stable society. But again, going back to Robert Keegan's model there of personal development, in a very stable society, it might even be beneficial for the society if most of us are in a socialized mind, just accepting the norms and the reality of society and being happy and carving out an existence within that certainty. That might even be not as anxiety inducing as living in a more rapidly developing society. Mm. But when we are living in a rapidly developing society or even a transitional society, then of course, if we were all just in a socialized mind replicating society, that wouldn't work because we need a societal shift. Even if we were just saying that we need an adoption to the developing technology, you need to have a critical amount of people in that society that can take a more detached, to have a more detached relationship to the present culture and be actively contributing in this transition. And in order for you to be able to do that, you need to somehow, as you can't take the guidance for your actions and values from the outside, you need to have developed a good relationship to your own inner compass. And that's what we're talking about, this self-authoring. And then you mentioned this very rare, I could perhaps say that, as I know that you and your network are using the model and the language of Robert Keegan, for those who are new to this, we could just mention that some estimates would say that perhaps in today's Western world, if we are lucky, perhaps half of us all might at some point in life, for many much later in life, take this step of going from the socialized mind to a more self-authoring mind. And that this transition is often triggered by some sort of personal challenging event. It could be the death of your parents. It could be losing your job or a divorce or something like that. And then you all of a sudden you might realize that even if you are a very successful lawyer, you're partnering one of the big law firms in town, but you realize that the life that you've been living is not your own life. It's your father's life. Your father wanted to become this lawyer, but he didn't have the opportunity to study, and he put you through law school, and now you're living your father's life. You're not living your own life. You might not realize that until you are 55 and have your first heart attack or something like that. So, of course, then having a society like we did in Scandinavia 100 years ago, who tried to put you in that process already in your 20s, or say that you at least in the beginning of your 30s go through the process of trying to find your own life instead of living somebody else's life, whether it's your parents' life or if it's your idol's life or if it's just society's life, would of course be a benefit. But again, at least 50% of us all in the West, we never wake up from the socialized mind. But then this self-authoring mind is much more rare. We are talking about just a few percentage. And
self-transforming, you mean? Or...
Self-transforming mind. And it is usually associated with wisdom and of a bit also comes with age. And If you need many people with a self-transformed, self-authoring mind to be able to be co-creators in a rapidly developing society, you also need a few people who can really take the biggest systemic perspective and also hold the biggest time frames and also hold the contradictions in this developmental process. And in indigenous populations, this was usually the role of the elders. But today we have lost that function in society. So today society is basically run by quite ego-driven, self-authoring people, and the few self-transforming or wiser people that we have are often marginalized within our structures, whether they are we're talking in a corporation or in a political party. So I think it's we are standing at the point where we need to both re-evaluate our ability to just harness the wisdom that is already existing in society with a few self-transforming individuals that we have, and then also possibly help to support and facilitate that development in more people. And just knowing the fact that we actually can develop these higher stages of consciousness is so important, both for us as individuals to know that our development does not end when we are, our cognitive and emotional development doesn't end when we are 20 or something, but that this is a lifelong process and that you are not done even if you are 55 or 65 or 75, that this is an ongoing development. If we all know that, then we can be more active in our own participation in our individual development. But also if we were to know about this as a society, we could as a society create, using Robert Keegan's language, he sometimes talking about that we need deliberately developmental organizations, organizations that support the personal development of all its employees. I would say that we today need deliberative development of societies that knows about this lifelong developmental potential and make that really a core of the politics to support that development and to harness the potential that is released through that development.
You said a couple of things here. I'd love to, I've got a couple of ideas and inspired by what you said, I'd love to throw to you and see what you make of it. I like that you talk about we find our own place, you know, what is ours to give. And that could be one of the ways we find our way through these times in terms of being in the process. Because I've certainly felt the developmental dojo of our times, you know, that and at least in myself and amongst some of the people I know, that it's brought out this deeper sense of calling or service. Like, oh yeah, things are going a bit weird and a bit crazy, and it evokes inside of me this sense of what's mine to give in these times. And so, that's got me wondering about: do we have enough time? You know, you talked about the small percentage of people that move to self-transforming. And even, you know, that only maybe 50% of people go to self-authoring. And so I wonder about whether we've got enough time and that there might be other areas that we can leverage. For example, this sense of calling, you know, that if people can actually begin to tune into a sense of calling and even the question, like, not what do I want with my life, but what does life want with me? That might actually be a kind of bigger catalyst to people being a contribution in these times than if we just work through the pure conceptual, rational, developmental lineage, you know. So I guess, I hope this is making sense. I'm trying to construct my point, because the imagery point is really important.
We say that we use this word rational development, it's important, of course, to stress that this lifelong developmental journey is both, at least both cognitive and emotional. And that these times are calling for us all to be able to hold both cognitive and emotional and relational and many other complexities at the same time. That is why personal development is such a difficult thing to do, you know. It's really operating on many, many different levels and layers.
Yeah, no, I agree. But then somehow, maybe there's this sense of like there are other types of knowing that maybe we lost connection with, for example, through the Enlightenment era that, you know. So, for example, like, and I think you talk about the word soul, but like even the word soul, it doesn't appear in any of like Hegan's developmental literature. And I think, you know, I get why, because it's kind of hard to measure. His work is very, like diligent, and it's been measured scientifically, and that's a good thing.
Yes.
But then something about the this word soul that's been left out, and I wonder if, if you recaptured that word.
And I think it is. I think it is. Is coming back, and the small research institute in London that Jonathan Rowson and I started a couple of years ago, called Perspectiva, we actually have as our tagline the three words: systems, souls, and society. So we are definitely trying to recapture the word soul in not necessarily a religious context, but certainly in some sort of spiritual context. So I think I think we should dare to start using that word again, if for nothing else as just a term for the totality of our inner worlds, which are, of course, much, much deeper and richer than just our conscious mind or even our unconscious mind. Our inner world is connected, as we all know, with neurosystems in the heart, with the guts of our intestines, but also all the way down to the chemical substance, signal substance in our blood. And that's just the individual side. Then we know that from mirror neurons, we are connected, these systems, with each other. So you could say that we are all connected souls, connected to each other, but also connected to our culture and to our environment and to nature and to the universe. So I'm totally with you there. But also it's important not to use a language that is that some people find difficult to relate to. And we are still very much in this scientific paradigm. So I think Robert Keegan did the right thing when he was writing in the 80s and in the 90s, where he wrote his most important books, to stay completely within a scientific paradigm and do empirical measures of these things that helps these things get accepted. And it's amazing to see how this has become very accepted, a sort of inner development or even consciousness development, but mainly, I would say, so far in the West, from the business community. I mean, we have leadership development consultants that has helped top management in large corporations to be on this inner maturation journey for decades. And now this is more and more corporations are starting to wake up to the fact that this is something now in a complex world that is not just necessary for corporations to support the top management in their development, but actually everyone in rapidly developing, say, technological innovative organization needs to be supported in the inner development so that we can all in the organization take a great responsibility for the totality. You cannot any longer run a tech development organization, not even a fairly large organization like, say, Spotify in Stockholm, just by looking at narrow, small, broken down tasks. More and more of us need to be able to take a more self-management role and take a larger responsibility for the totality. And that entails personal development. And that's why, again, some people are talking about the need for deliberately developmental companies, organizations. And I would say deliberately developmental societies. That's where we need to go.
Yeah. Now, there were some great experiments going on. I know of one huge global company that's combined developmental work with agile, being agile, and, you know, the whole company's going through a huge transition in that way with many learnings coming from it. So,
but I didn't really answer your question about what can we do in the short term. And you are very right in pointing out that what we are talking about here might even be intergenerational work. It might be work that takes long, long time. And we don't have that much time. I mean, we can clearly see that not only our environment is breaking down, but also our democratic systems in many countries are starting to break down. So what can we do now? And before answering that, I just want to quote my friend, the African philosopher Bayo Akomolafe, and he has got this wonderful quote, and he usually says like this: "My ancestors tell me we are an emergency. We have to slow down." And I think that is very wise, because our Western default reaction when we are facing a crisis is to go straight to action. So what can we do now? But that might be part of the problem, the way we are reacting. So the part of the answer might be that, no, we have to slow down. We have to slow down. It has to take the time it takes, and so on. So that would be one way of answering the question. The other way of answering the question is saying, working on personal development takes a long time. Going back to the projects we had in Scandinavia more than 100 years ago, it takes generations. I mean, at least 20 years, 30 years or something like that to really lift the consciousness level of a nation. And now we need to lift the consciousness level of the globe. So yes, we should work on that project. But then I also think that we already today have a lot of untapped consciousness in society. It's just that our systems are not putting a premium on these more wiser way of seeing the world. We even as citizens, we demand from our politicians clear answers. Is it yes or is it no? And what is the action you are going to take now? And any politician that is trying to hold the complexity and see both sides of the paradox would quite quickly be voted out of office. So I think if we could promote a cultural shift and a shift in worldview, where we would start realizing that the old worldview and the old map that we have been using to navigate the world during the last 200 years from the Enlightenment, that, yes, that has been very beneficial to humanity in many ways. And we shouldn't just throw out the old map like that, because that map has given us modern medicine. It's given us democracy. It's given us human rights. We wouldn't want to not have those things, and we hope to continue and develop along those lines. But certainly that old worldview needs at least to be strongly complemented with new ways of seeing the world. such as we already mentioned. Yes, we are these individuals, and we shouldn't forget that we are individuals, and we should cherish the fact that we are individual and that we can individuate in Jung's language, and that we could become authors of our own lives, become self-authoring. We don't want to go back to the undifferentiated collective of the Middle Ages. But we are also part of this greater collective, and we are interconnected. And how can we hold these two perspectives at the same time? Perhaps shifting from the view of the world, seeing the world more of things and nouns, and starting to see the world more in terms of processes, going into some sort of process philosophy, and see how these processes are interconnected and nested in each other. To go from the old worldview of seeing our mind as a rational machine that is fully developed when we are 20, to realize that our mind is a complex organic system and a constant development through our life, and that that development can actually be supported. Perhaps another shift would be to realize that we can't just take the human world and accept it as it is, as if it was given to us by God or by nature, but realizing that we are actually constantly creating and recreating this social world, whether we are aware of it or not. And again, start to not immediately throw out nation states and money, but becoming aware of the water that we are swimming in and realizing that we have collective agency over concepts like this. And then finally, if I should mention one more worldview shift, might be to stop just focusing on the material growth and focus on GDP and focusing on the material aspects of life. They are, of course, your highest priority if you are starving and without shelter. But for most people in the Western world, I might even say most people in the world today, luckily, we have come to a point where we could leave this focus on the material aspects of life and start looking into aspects like purpose and meaning and investigate that part. And that would be the meaningful part of growth in the future, not the growth of GDP, but the growth of meaning and purpose in our lives.
That idea just lights me up. What a world that could be if we did that.
Yeah, and this, I mean, changing our worldview like this is not done overnight, but it doesn't need to take 20 years. I mean, we've seen before in our fairly recent history how we in the world, in different parts of the world, have changed views of certain things quite quickly. So a concerted effort to expand our worldview to include these other perspectives as well could be a project that could take 10 years or something like that. And again, it's not a question of reaching everyone, but in these self-organizing complex systems like our civilization, probably if 5%, 10%, 15% of us all started to see the world and started to relate to ourselves, to each other, relate to society and relate to the planet in new ways, that could be this tipping point that gets the whole system to tip over into a new way of operating.
Yeah. Well, I'm aware of the time, and I want to make sure, that we give you enough time to transition. I just want to express my gratitude, Thomas, for your mind and your ability to, you know, weave this picture, this, this complex set of ideas together for us today. And actually, you know, I, the more I look at the work you're doing, just to say thanks for what you're up to in the world, because, I really see you being a player, creating these initiatives that are touching people's lives. So I'm grateful you're doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we are many that do that. So if some of your listeners are interested in exploring these ideas, yeah. I would recommend one of the initiatives in our ecosystem, which is a media platform run out of Berlin called Emerge. And the URL is whatisemerging.com. There you can all find a lot of thinkers and doers and projects in this area that can serve us as food for thought or inspiration to us all.
Yeah, yeah, thanks. And I also recommend Perspectiva as an organization for people to check out. There's some great writing there
absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely, that's a bit more abstract and academic, but absolutely. We are out with 5 new books this spring, and one particular that I like very much, which is about meta-modernity. So I believe that we come from the pre-modern world into the modern world. We have the postmodern critique of the modern world, which is very important and that we need to take on, but we can't build a new society just with postmodern critique. So after the postmodern, after the postmodern, we need to move on to the metamodern and to explore what that could mean.
Great. Well, that's maybe the topic for our next podcast. Well, then, Thomas, I hope our paths cross again soon, and I wish you well the rest of your day.
Yeah, and thank you for this conversation, and thank you for your work with your podcast and everything else that you are doing.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is, for me, the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this. And it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches, because our times are calling for something deeper. We've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com, put your name in the sign-up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.